Yes, welcome back to Coast AM. Well, coming right up, we're going to turn our attention to the evidence of mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity with Jan Ervin. He is someone who has gone through the vast corridors of history and has found different clues and symbology that tells a different story. You're going to be really surprised how much sense all of this makes when you look at it from a different point of view. His website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Stay tuned. Our next guest will go through some of the evidence that he's collected to suggest how mind-altering substances played a part in the development of Judaism and Christianity. He's the author of the book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity and Astrotheology and Shamanism, Christianity's Pagan Roots. Jan Ervin, thank you for coming to Coast AM. Welcome.
Rob, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely a pleasure. And I think it's really a good timing that we're talking about this so close to Christmas. How did you first get involved in the Gnostic text? Were you always someone who was seeking out an alternative view to history and archaeology?
Well, you know, I originally started researching the history of shamanism and religions back in my early 20s, probably, about 18, 19 years ago. And I had worked with Jack Hare and the California Hemp Initiative. And this type of research was something that Jack was interested in at that time. And he had mentioned to me some things about the possibility that early Judeo-Christians had used mind-altering substances and things like that. And at the time, before I had really looked into it, I thought that the entire idea seemed pretty absurd, and I remember at the time really just dismissing it. But Jack was very persistent with me, and he insisted that I read this book by the name of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross by a guy named John Allegro. And I remember sitting down at 22 or 23 years old and reading that book and just being completely mind blown. And it's, you know, and I knew that there was a lot of attacks out there in the press and in academia against this guy's work. And so at the time I set out researching his work and checking his citations and things like that. And over the years, I accumulated a significant amount of research and images and texts and things like that to support his work.
Well, the John Allegro you speak of, he was involved in some of the early interpretations of the Dead Sea Scrolls, right?
Exactly. In fact, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947, and in 1953 they were putting a team together. And they went to Oxford to ask Oxford to recommend somebody who could help them translate the Dead Sea Scrolls. And Oxford recommended John Allegro, who was working on his doctorate degree there at the time in Oriental languages, which the Middle Eastern region is considered part of Asia, so it falls under Oriental languages there.
Okay.
So, you know, he was basically an expert in Semitic languages, but so in 1953, they put this team together, and he right away started to see correlations that made him question his Judeo-Christian beliefs. And in 1956, he went on the BBC radio saying that there was evidence that a figure called the Teacher of Righteousness in the Dead Sea Scrolls paralleled with many aspects of the story of Jesus Christ. And immediately, the rest of the scrolls team separated themselves from him, and it pretty much went on like that from then on. And from there until 1968, he was the first one to publish anything on the Dead Sea Scrolls. In fact, Allegro was really the only one that put anything out on the scrolls for the first 15 or 20 years after their discovery. And the rest of the team didn't publish anything until 1997. So we're talking 50 years after they were originally discovered.
So John came up through normal academia, and do you think it was during his work in the field that he started seeing these different clues for the use of these mind-altering substances, and that's where he keen to put together the material for his book?
Well, I think originally he read the works of another British scholar, Robert Graves, who had published a number of books at the time. He'd also come across the work of Professor John Ramsbottom at London Botanical Museum, who had argued in a book, Mushrooms and Toadstools, that the story of Adam and Eve in the tree, with the tree of knowledge, was in fact a story about mushrooms. And this guy presented an image which had been presented in 1911 or 1912 in a French mycological journal. But he presented this image again and argued that it was, in fact, the mushroom. And Allegro saw this, and he had also seen Robert Graves talk about the mushroom. So he, at that point, really began investigating Judeo-Christianity to see if there were any correlations there. Now, in 1967, before Allegro published his first book in this specific area in 1970, which was The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, in 1967, a guy by the name of Gordon Wasson, who is a banker who also worked as a chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, etc., came out and said in a book called Soma that the Rig Vedas were based on the Amanita muscaria mushroom. So Allegro, with his background in the Dead Sea Scrolls, Semitic languages, ancient religions, and the like, he thought that Judeo-Christianity couldn't be any different. So he set out to find this evidence, and he published his work, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, in 1970. Now, in that book, he really focused on linguistic evidence, and since then, we've focused a lot on iconographic evidence and textual evidence. Myself and a number of other researchers, including a couple of professors, one at Boston University, we published dozens of new images that weren't available when Allegro was around. And we've also since published the first ancient primary texts that specifically discussed the holy mushroom, like my book, The Holy Mushroom, is titled after this text that we discovered called the Epistle to the Renegade Bishops, wherein they discuss specifically the quote-unquote holy mushroom.
Okay, I want to talk about that. Now, of course, Gordon Wasson, who you just mentioned, he was wasn't he vice president for J.P. Morgan?
Well, yeah, he was vice president of public relations for J.P. Morgan Bank, and he worked with he was close friends with a guy by the name of Edward Bernays, who wrote a book in 1928 called Propaganda that was about the elite using propaganda to control the masses. And so Gordon Wasson, he was the vice president for J.P. Morgan Bank, in charge of public relations or PR and this type of spin. So naturally, he would be friends with the founder of the field, right? But Wasson also co-authored the Stock Exchange Act, or the Securities Exchange Act. He was a chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was all of these other different characters, but he was sold to the public as this very soft character who was really, just a happenstance to fall onto this mushroom story when he and his wife were on their honeymoon in New York, and she rushed off into the woods to pick some mushrooms, and he thought for sure he would be a widower, and this sort of stuff. And this is the legend that the world has been sold about this man. And, you know, many of your listeners may not be familiar with him, but in the mycology world, this guy is completely famous. He is the god, basically, of ethnomycology and ethnobotany, and he's considered the founder of the field. And I've found a lot of evidence that makes that that claim questionable.
Right. Well, we're going to get into that, but let's first sort of paint a picture here. If people think back thousands of years ago, even hundreds of thousands of years ago, there were all kinds of plants and all kinds of fungus just naturally growing that produce significant hallucinatory and mind-altering effects. And so back then, it's easy to understand that that experience could be interpreted as religious. And your books...
Exactly. You're right. Let me just interrupt you, Rob, and just say real quick that you're exactly on target right there. But not only that, but Johns Hopkins University professor Roland Griffiths there has done research to show that magic mushrooms do, in fact, cause a religious experience that's indistinguishable from those written about in the ancient religious texts.
Fascinating. Well, I was going to get into the beginning of the book where you talk about Adam and Eve. I think it's a great place to start because there's a lot of art in the medieval and the ancient world that shows this, but it really is a focal point.
Well, sure. And in fact, if people go to the Coast to Coast AM website, if they go to the image section that is up there for this interview, on the second page, down towards the bottom, which is image number 11, at the very bottom of that page is the Plain Corot fresco from 1291 France, which depicts Adam and Eve on either side of the mushroom tree in a Christian chapel there in France. And it was hotly debated for decades whether or not this image really showed mushrooms, but we've since found many dozens of images. In fact, between Professor John Rush and myself, we probably have about 2,500 to 3,000 images total showing the mushrooms like this in Christian art.
Yeah, and in the beginning of the book, you have a lot of correspondence going back between Gordon Wasson and John Allegro. And
you're talking about my Holy Mushroom book.
Yeah, you focus on the Adam and Eve symbology and how in a lot of depictions of this, there is what seems to be a mushroom and not a tree of knowledge.
Right, exactly. And in fact, we think that and there are many levels to the mystery. There can be often as many as 7 or 10 different interpretations for each symbol. We think that the mushroom, in many respects, is the tree of knowledge. Of course, there are other levels that Kabbalists would point out, and we could also point out that even the mushroom, it can be seen as the fruit in the Kabbalic tree of knowledge as well. But the tree of knowledge and the fruit of knowledge is something that plays out in nearly every ancient mythology, not just Judeo-Christian mythology. We have very similar myths in, say, for instance, the Bwiti tribe in Africa or in Japanese traditions and things like that. So we have the story of Soma in the Rig Vedas, which is this plant or this fruit that brings spiritual enlightenment. And it's long been argued, really today, Soma is no longer argued if it was an entheogen or a psychedelic. It's rather argued which psychedelic substance that it was.
And there's a great picture here. If you go to coasttocoastam.com and go to the images for tonight's show, there's a slide about the fresco in France that has really been the center of some disagreement between mainstream archaeology and people with a different point of view.
Right, and when you get into the arguments on each side of this, and we really got in and analyzed the arguments, and what's interesting is that the art historians argued that mycologists don't read art history books, right? But then later on, they admitted that they don't read mycology books either. And on the front cover of my book, The Holy Mushroom, is an image from Montferrand du Perigord, France, that depicts Jesus as a mushroom riding on the back of St. Christopher. And we actually sent this image to a mycologist who was able to identify the specific mushroom that is depicted there. And not only was he able to identify it, but it's a mushroom that's found commonly growing right outside that chapel.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this photograph that's on the website, it looks to me clearly like a mushroom. If you had asked me to identify that even before I did the show, I probably would have said the same thing.
Sure. And, they make all kinds of twists to make it look like different types of pine trees and things like that. But what they forget to admit is that a pine tree is the host for this type of mushroom.
And going through your book, more and more images just spill out. And it's astonishing how many mushrooms have been painted conjunction with Jesus, with the Garden of Eden. Does this trend focus on a particular area, or is this scattered throughout the Eastern and Western world?
Well, that's a very good question. Are you talking specifically Judeo-Christianity? That's one question. Or It would be the answer to your question on a global basis is that there are very few cultures and religions that we don't find psychoactive substances in use at some point during their religious genesis. For Judeo-Christianity, we find the history of mushrooms from deep in Siberia all the way to the British Isles. And in both of my books, I've published images from England, from the Canterbury Anglo Cattle and Psalter, that very clearly depicts many, many images of mushrooms and even mushrooms inside of the mushrooms. And in the Canterbury Psalter, it really has some fascinating information in there Adam and Eve is in that one. It shows one image of Jesus as the Lord of magical plants. He's depicted in 12 panes. That's the story of Genesis, but in the top right pane, Jesus or Lord is standing over four very distinct mushrooms. And when we think of ancient shamanic cultures around the world, these traditions, everywhere you look, these traditions are found to be based on these plant substances. Whether it's in South America, we think of ayahuasca and San Pedro cactus, or in Mexico with psilocybe mushrooms, or aleliuqui, which is morning glories, and many other substances that they use there, and the Ojibwa tribe up in the Great Lakes area that uses Amanita muscaria mushrooms. And then we go into Europe where they use datura and belladonna and mandrake and these things. And then down into the Middle East, where we find a history not only in this text that I published, but we can find in the Kabbalah and the Book of Zohar, discussion of red mushrooms are found there. There's a Muslim text which is debated currently if it's talking about truffles or mushrooms. But there's a text in the Muslim Mishkat that also discusses mushrooms being used for sight, and whether or not it's spiritual or physical sight is being debated by scholars right now. So it's not really a question of if these substances are used as the foundation of many of the religions. It's really just getting in there and looking at this information with an open mind. Now, speaking of which, John Allegro, he really had his career destroyed when he went public with this information in 1970. And it took, if you can believe this, Rob, until this year, until it was either the last week of January, the first week of February 2011, when Boston University, Professor Carl Ruck there, taught the very first class ever using the sacred mushroom and the cross this year. So 41 years since the book was published.
Wow. Well, the progress happens slowly. They say a new paradigm happens one funeral at a time. And sometimes sometimes you just have to wait that long. But well, let me just ask you, because I'm just curious about this. Have you found evidence of these frescoes or these paintings of mushrooms showing specific kind of mushrooms that are not that don't grow in that area from which they were made?
Well, you know, and a lot of people, that's interesting that you would mention that. A lot of people would say, well, Amanitas are not found in the Middle East area, such as around Israel and Jordan, where we claim that a lot of these things were found. But in fact, Robert Graves reported in 1952 or 56 that he reported seeing them there. But one thing that many people forget is that, like the cedars of Lebanon, way back in the day, was this massive forest that would have been an absolute excellent host to these mushrooms, and that forest is pretty much entirely gone today. But in Hindu tradition, what's interesting is in many areas, it is suggested that the mushroom must be purchased from someone outside or stolen from someone outside. So in many of these practices, it is taboo for them to acquire these substances within their own community, and they go out and they get it from some trader or they steal it from somebody.
Well, you know what? A lot of that happens today in much the same way with these same kind of substances. We're talking with Jan Ervin. We're exploring the evidence of mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity and the pagan roots of Christianity. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. We are back talking about a different way to decode the history of some of the great religions and the icons and the imagery that goes along with them. They start to tell a different story when you look at it from a different perspective. I mean, and it makes sense in a way because, you know, you take the concept, the metaphor of a mushroom and all the spores going out and floating around. I mean, it's a very close parallel to the idea of religion and how it spreads and how little messages fly on the wind and they turn to grow other people and churches and faiths. It's a strong symbolism there. We're talking with Jan Irwin, and we're going through this very interesting subject. Now, some of the images that we're talking about are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. You can see some of these different plates and some of these different examples of the artwork. And I didn't mention before, but, you know, there's a new way to listen to Coast to Coast AM on your iPhone, on your iPad, Android phones. It's all possible if you are a Coast Insider. Go to the website, take a look, and see how easy it is just to hear everything that you want whenever you want it. It's all about making it easier for you. We're coming back with Jan Irwin right after this. We're back. And just before the break, Jan, let's just finish that thought because I think that was really interesting. We were talking about these different frescoes and paintings showing Jesus as a mushroom or mushrooms involved and with the Virgin Mary or Garden of Eden. And I was just wondering if there was anything that that you had found that suggested they were depicting mushrooms that weren't even native to the area.
That they were depicting mushrooms not native to a specific region.
Or to the region where this art was made.
Well, you know, I would say that, you know, there is a lot of copying in the artwork, but what's interesting is more often than not, it seems that much of the artwork gets adopted to substances that do tend to be available in the local vicinity.
Okay.
And, you know, there are some exceptions to the rule, but, you know, it's kind of an interesting question. Very rarely would I say that I have found iconography of images not found in the local vicinity.
Okay. Because there is that temple in India that depicts corn. And of course, at the time that was made, they should have no idea about corn. And I was just wondering if there was any crossover like that.
No, I'd have to see the image of that as well.
Sure.
You know, and
sure.
I know that corn is something that has been developed by humankind. There's, what, 400 or 500 different types of corn that have been developed by indigenous cultures alone. So,
okay.
I'd have to look at that. And I do know that there was a lot of trade, pan-Pacific trade happening. A couple of thousand years ago, there's been evidence and archaeological finds that have shown that there was trade between India and the New World. So I'm not sure that I would be against them possibly having something like corn or depicting
sure.
somewhere like that.
Yeah, well, let's look at the big picture for a minute. We're seeing this concept being woven into a lot of different cultures. Do you think that there was some sort of lost society that held the knowledge specific to the mushroom psychoactive substances?
I personally don't think that. I know that some do, but what I think happened, and you know, I really do think that the cradle of civilization is India. And if you go back far enough, pretty much just about every philosophy out there can be traced at some point at its core level into India. Buckminster Fuller was famous for putting forward ideas showing that India is really the cradle of civilization. I've lost my train of thought on that. So remind me what.
I was just talking about if was there, along with this knowledge, if there was this influence of mushroom in Judeo-Christianity,
right.
Was there also a society
there a cradle
or a hierarchy or some sort of collective lost religion or lost keepers of this that really were the ones that were responsible for holding on to this almost forgotten legacy?
Well, you know, you could say that there were many different religions that carried this, but you know, and that's a question that I've thought about for a good 10 or 15 years, and I don't really think that there's evidence of a central core religion that ignited it all, except out of India. But, you know, what there is you have some core themes. You have archaeoastronomy, which is paying attention to the sun and the moon and the stars so that you can tell time, so that you know when to plant, when to harvest, when to store your food so that you don't die. You also have the story of religious experience that is found in the local vicinity, and each of these cultures were hunter-gatherers. They would be looking for things that they could consume for food, and when they came across medicinal substances, including poisonous for warfare, and often poison is just the level or the amount of a plant that you use versus it being used for healing, and then, you know, for that same plant possibly being used for religious experience. So what you have is a foundation sort of globally of things that would automatically lead a species like humans to sort of automatically discover and go with those things. If you didn't know when to plant your food, you died. The shaman and religious aspects, you know, people didn't have televisions and radios and things like that to distract them at night. They would meditate, go into caves, take psychoactive substances and things like that. So I'm not really one to believe in a theory of a global ancient religion, so to speak. There is evidence that there was a global sort of mushroom cult, but did it have a central figurehead or a central a religious center or anything like that? I don't think so. I think that it's just that people, wherever they were, when they walked behind cattle, and cows are religious, for instance, in India, you walk behind a cow, you're going to eventually discover mushrooms like psilocybe cubensis, which grow in cow dung and happen to be able to put you in a very spiritual religious state. So I think this is really more along the lines of what took place than a central, like, control center.
Okay. Well, we just came off of Christmas, and we're entering into New Year. Talk to us about some of the alternative creations of St. Nicholas in the Christmas tradition.
Oh. Well, you know, here's where we can get into some real fun here. So we might as well just take a little journey here into the whole Christmas theme, because Christmas is a very fascinating story to unravel, to really understand how ancient religions affect the religions of today and the practices of today. And most of us can remember as children being told the story of Santa Claus, and maybe you're told that, you know, if you're good, you'll get presents. If you're bad, you might get a lump of coal. You can even remember maybe the first time you were told by a sibling or a teacher or your parents that Santa Claus wasn't real. And in the media lately, there's been an uproar of this school teacher who told her second grade class that Santa wasn't real. But today, you know, we can go a lot deeper than these sort of superficial histories and take a journey into the history of Christmas and Santa Claus, and sort of bring out what the myth is all about, and is it really myth, and what reality is there behind it. And I think by doing so, we gain a much deeper appreciation for the holiday season.
Okay.
And, you know, so up on the Coast to Coast AM website, image number one up there is a depiction of Jesus being born under a star, and this is a very common theme. And why is Jesus being born under this star? And the star, I think, is the star Sirius, which in image number two, directly below that, you can see star Sirius pointing directly at the Earth below the belt of Orion on the upper half of that split screen there, which where it says Christmas Eve. But I also think that Jesus is depicted there in that image. He's really being depicted as the sun. And why would the sun be important around the Christmas celebrations? And why would the sun be amalgamated into this character that we're told was a literal historical person named Jesus? And I think it's because the sun gives us food and clothing and shelter. And, you know, the photosynthesis in the plants becomes the medicines and inebriants and poisons and the lumber for the homes and fuel for the fire and things like that. And the sun has been worshipped around the world by many ancient cultures. And it just so happens that the sun dies and is reborn again at Christmas time. And to many people, that may sound completely absurd, but you know, what we have is really this this story of around Christmas of the death and birth of the sun. That's what the whole tradition was originally about. And you know, those who live in the southern hemisphere of our globe would experience these things in our summertime versus us in their summertime. So. But many Christian art depictions depict God as being born under a star. And is there a correlation between this and the events that are happening that night in the sky? And I think that these are things that are blatantly obvious when we get in and we really begin to, you know, well, first we have to lay our biases aside and our predisposed religious beliefs, and we have to look at things, how ancient peoples and cultures would have seen these things and how they would have marked time changes and calendar changes to themselves during the year. And so, you know, this split screen, which is image number 2, is really showing this alignment, this marker point of what marks what today we call Christmas Day. But to the ancients, this would have been the real New Year's Day. And I think that that Christmas and New Year's have been separated into two and different distinct days to hide the correlation that this is really, Christmas Day is really the beginning of the new year. It's when the sun begins to head north again. And it happens directly underneath the constellation of Orion. You have the three stars in the belt. They almost align with the star Sirius, who sort of barks the return of the flooding of the Nile at this time of year. Of course, it's right there, I believe, just in the southern hemisphere there. And then on Christmas morning, about 6:30 in the morning, the sun is born under this direct alignment. And people can look on software like Stellarium and things like that, and they can follow along looking directly east. They'll see this alignment happening right over, right over there, the sky on Christmas Eve and Christmas morning. So this is the death and rebirth of the sun, or the sun in the sky, is something that everyone can go out and see every single year. Hmm. And, you know, if we consider what happens to the sun during the autumn or fall, from the summer solstice, which is roughly June 21st, until the winter solstice, the sun appears closer to the south each day, and the shadows change a little bit. You'll notice that, you know, the shadows in your house are a little bit different every day. And from summer to winter solstice, the days get a little bit shorter, the nights get longer, the days are colder. And from the summer solstice until the winter solstice, the sun falls literally toward the south each day. And then from the winter solstice until the summer solstice, the sun begins to rise more and more to the north each day, the opposite. But what happens is on December 21st, on the winter solstice, the sun doesn't just bounce right back to the north again. Okay, what happens is basically for the naked eye, for people living 2,000 years ago, looking out to the east and watching this whole thing, it appeared that the sun actually stopped moving north or south for 3 days.
Just lingers.
It just lingers there. And that's what the word solstice actually means. It means sun stands still. So the sun would stand still for 3 days. And then on Christmas morning, on December 25th, after it's 3 days in the tomb, it begins gradually to head north again towards spring and summertime, towards the fertility of spring and the warmth of summer and planting the crops and everything, and then this whole cycle repeats.
Mm-hmm. And going on to some of the other aspects where the idea of Christmas and the familiar things that go along with it, like Santa Claus, how has that been shaped over the years?
Well, Santa Claus is a very interesting story. And, you know, what I want to do is I'm just going to go over some of my notes here, because Santa Claus over the years really started, its earliest form is shamanism. And the modern form comes from Washington Irving in his Knickerbocker History of New York in 1809, Henry Livingston Jr., and Professor Clement Clark Moore. They wrote a story about Christmas in 1822. We have William Boyd, Susan Warner, Thomas Nast, and Harper's Weekly in 1863, Norman Rockwell, and then Coca-Cola. All of these organizations and people contributed to what is the current depiction of Santa Claus. But when we go back and we look at the story anciently, and in fact, image 4 up on your website is an image of Baba Yaga, or Grandmother Yaga, which is it's a Russian-like grandmother of the woods. And she goes out and she meets the three wise men. And the three wise men are actually, they just happen to be depicted there in image number 3. And for those who question if there were three, because the Bible doesn't actually mention three wise men, but there were three, and the Catholic Church actually had a cult that recognized them in Cologne, but their names are Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar, which are posted up there. And they, Baba Yaga, which is in image 4, she goes out there and she meets these three wise men, and she's associated anciently in Russian traditions with giving presents to the children.
Okay.
So this is, where we first have this first tie to this St. Nicholas sort of Christmas story of this character that gives presents to the children. And then from there, the story goes into the ancient shamanic symbol of Hearn, which is in image 5 on the right side there. And Hearn is sort of an amalgamation of the reindeer or the Siberian deer and a human figure. And what happens is this character, he sort of eventually gets morphed into this character that we know of, the Roman god Pan, who had a goat's head and goat's feet and a man's body, right? And he would go around with all this licentious behavior, and he would try and have sex with the women and be drunk and party and do all of these bad things. And so what we have here is a connection from this shaman story, this character of Hearn, being and shamanism and inebriation with the mushroom and things like that, being brought forward into Roman times with this character or the god Pan. And then in the Saturnalian rites of Rome, they would have this orgiastic party for several days around the Christmas season.
So Pan sounds like sort of the Charlie Sheen of the ancient world.
What's that?
He sounds like the Charlie Sheen of the ancient world.
Oh, the Charlie Sheen of the ancient world. That's funny. Well, I guess if you want to give all of the over publicity that the media gives that. But, I guess in a sort of way, if you want to give a modern day pun to it. But so if we go to page 2 of the images, what happens is this character Hearn, and then who became Pan, up in the top image on page 2 is image number 6. This character becomes Pels Nikel, or Krampus, in many of the European versions of the Christmas story, and he's Saint Nicholas's devilish helper.
Yeah, looks like the devil. I mean, that little kid he's got in his clutches looks terrified.
Right, exactly. But he's actually St. Nicholas's dark helper. So this Pan Hearn character, what he did was he would go around and sort of deal out the punishment for the naughty kids. And in the image there on the right, we can see the kids worrying that Pels Nikel is behind Santa Claus there, right? And they're worried if they were good and going to get presents, or if they were bad and get a lump of coal, or worse, Pels Mikkel was going to run
right.
off with them.
Right. Right. Worse, a visit from this unsavory character. He's got the long tongue and the tail and horns. My goodness. Well, that is something we never really talk about with Santa. It's always about the gifts. What about the naughty children? They've been getting a bit of a pass lately in the modern world. Well, we're going to get more into this when we come back. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone.